Thank you. Well, let me first say that since I am leaving Norway tomorrow, I just thought to say I've had a really wonderful month here. I'm very grateful to the department for making that possible, so thank you. Maybe I should also say that my body seems to be so upset that I'm leaving Norway tomorrow that I've come down with some kind of a flu, so I guess that means several things. First of all, it means you probably should kiss me, I guess. But it also means that I may do a certain amount of coughing and nose blowing. I'm trying to quit myself. I'm not sure how much of a lecture you're going to get. I apologize for that in advance. It's a bit of a mess. The handout is really an outline of the lecture I would have given if I felt stronger. I think I will sort of jump through it and do as much as I feel able to. I no longer feel it's wise to be quite as ambitious as I was originally intending. So you're getting a somewhat scaled back version of the lecture. I'm sorry. I'm going to try to speak slowly so I don't fall apart. My body seems to be taking Harold's dictum that all good things must come to an end a little bit too literally. John McDowell and Kant is probably not a good way to sum up what I'm going to do today, because I'm not really going to talk about John McDowell. So then the title is advertised as John McDowell's Kant. That is to say, I'm going to talk about Kant. But as the title is meant to indicate, what I hope to do is give you a reading of Kant that will make it intelligible how it is that McDowell could seriously claim to be a Kantian and seriously claim to be vindicating the original aspirations of Kant's project, which I think to many seems like a rather peculiar thing for him to be saying. If you have anything like a standard reading of Kant, then McDowell's claim to be some kind of Kantian, I think, is bound to look somewhat disingenuous. So the aim today is to sketch a reading of Kant in which that could look, at least look sincere. Whether mistaken or not is a further matter we could take up in discussion. Secondly, it's to sketch a reading of Kant that I think opens up the possibility of a very different way of understanding Kant's relation to the history of analytic philosophy, figures like Frege, early Wittgenstein, later Wittgenstein, as well as the present. So there is a sort of standard understanding of, for lack of a better label, let's call it transcendental idealism, what transcendental idealism is. It figures in a certain kind of narrative of how that's under criticism in the major figures in the history of analytic philosophy. In offering you an alternative account of how you might understand what the aspiration of your long transcendental idealism is, I hope also to be at least implicitly suggesting a very different way of understanding that history, if those figures are better readers of Kant than they're sometimes given credit for. So that touches on a number of issues that perhaps we can take up in discussion. But as I said, today I will focus on Kant. Maybe I'll start with a rather provocative remark. Here's something I've noticed as I've read harder in the history of philosophy. I think it's arguably often the case, I won't go so far as to say always the case, but it's arguably often the case that the adjectives or nouns that are formed out of the last names of the great philosophers, Platonism, Aristotelianism, Kantianism, Wittgensteinianism, those seem to me four very good examples. It's arguably often the case that those names wind up naming not a position that philosopher is concerned to defend, but in fact, the very problematic that they're trying to overcome. That is, if you try to boil down an interesting philosopher into something that fits into an encyclopedia article, invariably what you wind up getting is the general shape of the problematic he's concerned with. But if that's all you've got, and then you try to convert it to a statement of a doctrine, you precisely misunderstand the philosopher in question. I'm going to suggest something like that is true of Kant today. We'll leave the others for another day. One way of putting very briefly the issue I'm concerned with here today with Kant would be to just think for a moment in very simple terms about two different things one can mean by the word subjective and subjectivity. Here's one way you could use these words. We could say a form of cognition, a form of sentience, a form of sensibility, or a form of sapience, say, forms of the understanding. Such forms are forms of subjectivity if they essentially depend on the constitution of the subject. So something counts according to this notion of subjectivity. If the subject must be disposed, if the subject's modes of cognition must be shaped in a certain sort of way in order for such cognition to so much as be possible. So a fairly transparent case, or uncontroversial case, of something that is a form of subjectivity in this sense is our capacity to perceive colors. We can be colorblind. It looks like we need certain forms of receptivity and sensitivity in order to perceive colors. We must be a certain way in order that we can be on to features of reality of that sort. So in that sense, the capacity for color perception is a form of subjectivity. And then we could ask, what other modes of cognition that we are possessed by are in that sense forms of subjectivity? Here's another thing you can mean by the word subjective or subjectivity. A form of cognition is subjective if it does not yield genuine knowledge of objects. It yields something which we take to be knowledge of objects, but really in a proper full description of how things really are. That's not how they are. So, in this use of subjective, there's really no difference between, say, a form of cognition is subjective and saying it's merely subjective, if you will. This sense of subjectivity is understood to be the opposite of objectivity. There's quite a bit of conflation of these two senses of subjectivity in talk of philosophy. But a question we could ask is, does the first sense entail the second sense? That is, for a mode of cognition to be a form of subjectivity in the first sense, is it, at the end of the day, in the final analysis, however much you want to go on about, well, it is intersubjectivity in some way, we all, see these things as red, is it, at the end of the day, still not a genuinely objective mode of cognition? Does this entail that? I take the example of colors advisedly because it was thought to be more or less of a truism in the early modern period that both colors were subjective in this sense and they were subjective in that sense. From, as it were, a sideways point of on view of the world, objects were extended, they were in space and time, there was some argument about whether they were solid or not. There was some dispute about what the primary qualities were. But whatever they were not the ones that yielded a kind of knowledge of objects we could only have in virtue of our form of subjectivity. And vice versa, the knowledge that objects were thought to have, as it were, in virtue of how they themselves are, were thought to be forms of knowledge about them that did not depend upon our forms of subjectivity. Hence what Berkeley essentially argued was, well, it looks like the primary qualities actually, in some sense, depend on our forms of subjectivity, too. Then leading to the opposite conclusion of what his predecessors wanted. So, here's a question about Kant. What does Kant think about this? The reading of Kant I'm going to suggest is that what Kant is concerned above all to do, so this is a description of Kant's aim. What Kant is concerned above all to do is to show us that we can make sense of the idea that our forms of cognition are, in this sense, forms of subjectivity, without their being, in this sense, merely subjective. That is, to block the appearance of such an entailment. That's a description of what Kant is trying to do. And then this raises questions about standard readings of Kant, because I think on most standard readings of Kant, what you have to conclude is either that can't be what he was trying to do, although there are passages that should suggest that's what he's trying to do, or you have to conclude he failed. In fact, he failed miserably. He failed so quickly, how could he have not noticed that he failed? And so the task then, if one wants to take the passages that suggest otherwise seriously, is to provide a reading of Kant that takes seriously that something like this was his aspiration. That's the kind of reading of Kant that I think McDowell is holding out for. And the respect in which McDowell can therefore see himself as a genuine inheritor of Kant, trying to vindicate that aspiration of Kant's. And the sense in which he then wants to, he's situating himself in a larger narrative, in which figures as diverse as Hegel and Frege and Wittgenstein can figure as further protagonists in a drama in which people are trying to vindicate such an aspiration. More about Hegel later. Let me put the same point a couple of different ways. I think all the ways I'm going to put this actually come to the same thing. But hearing the same point phrased in several different ways, I think, can bring out how fundamental the issue is. So here's a second way of putting, I think, what I just said. What we're looking for is the possibility of a view and a possibility of a reading of Kant in which he is trying to make room for view, in which we can have a non-restrictive conception of subjectivity. So let me explain what I mean by a non-restrictive conception of subjectivity. I'll do this simply by contrasting it with what we get on a standard reading of Kant. On most readings of Kant, there is the assumption of a substantive possibility, of a kind of substantive finite knowledge, which would, and if we could have it for us, would transpire in a wider sphere than the one in which we operate. So we are finite beings, and there's the imagination of a kind of being who, like us, is a finite being. But for this less finite being, the capacity to acquire knowledge would not run up against the limit, our space. It could have substantive knowledge that wasn't restricted in the way that ours is. So one of the issues here is, there's much talk about limits in Kant, but how should this talk be understood? Should it be understood as introducing the idea of a substantively restriction conception of subjectivity? Should we conclude that, for us, the capacity to have knowledge, and now I think it's hard not to say something like this, as it happens, given how we happen to be, does not operate within this wider sphere, but only within a narrower, more restricted sphere? So another question here is how to understand Kant's talk of conditions of knowledge. I think on standard readings, in the end, it's difficult not to understand this talk as a kind of device for demarcating this narrower sphere within the bounds of this presumptively wider substantive sphere of knowledge, which would in some sense be possible, only not for us, but which this less finite, but nonetheless genuinely discursive being might operate. So viewed from the standpoint of the wider sphere, if you think there is a wider sphere, looking at us, it's inevitable that it emerges as something like, to introduce a term, a brute fact, a merely contingent fact from this, as it were, wide. Some people think this is where the word transcendental belongs. From this transcendental perspective, it emerges as a merely brute or contingent fact about us that our knowledge is thus limited. To take our knowledge as thus limited is in some sense to view it as at the end of the day revealed as a subjective imposition on the things. So how should we understand Kant's talk of conditions of experience? I'm suggesting in most standard readings, these should be understood as restrictions, as showing us something we cannot do. Something that in some substantive sense we might be able to do, but alas, it turns out we can't. That's what I mean by restricted. Conditions of experience as restrictions then opens up a problem in Kant interpretation. Robert Pippin, a Kant interpreter I'll say a bit about later, I think has put this rather well by saying that it looks like, if you have something like the standard reading of Kant, it looks like the difficulty is to make sense of the idea that Kant thinks these are in some sense subjective conditions, but also in some strong sense necessary, without the sense of necessary being glossed to something like merely psychological facts about us, that the necessary not be some brute fact about how we cannot help but think, which as Kant says in section 27 of the deduction, would be to skip the skeptic who most desires. But some interesting non-psychological kind of condition, restrictive condition on knowledge. And I think it's fair to say that a lot of the better Kant commentary, certainly better Kant commentary in the Anglo-American tradition in which Pippin is a representative, is an attempt to understand Kant as seeking restrictive conditions that are nonetheless necessary, and yet necessary in a sense that can be glossed as non-psychological. And that's a very hard tightrope to walk without falling off, if you're honest about it. And then there's a tendency to understand many other people in the tradition, both in the phenomenological tradition and the analytic linguistic term tradition, as inheriting that goal of Kant's, as trying to give necessary restrictive conditions that are not merely psychologistic. So in the reading of Kant, what I'm suggesting is a completely different way to understand both Kant and what is more interesting about some of the figures who wish to inherit Kant, by suggesting that in trying to block this entailment, precisely what Kant's trying to do is understand these as genuine forms of subjectivity, but not thereby as restrictions in the substantive sense that generates the problem that Pippin is taking for granted we have to solve if we want to have a coherent form of consciousness. So, on this contrasting reading, which I'm suggesting we can see McDowell representing himself as coming out of, the task is to show that the conditions of experience that are subjective in this sense are not subjective in this sense. So that's a certain way of putting a threat that Kant is trying to avert. Actually, there's several issues here, but let's just put this for now as a point about our forms of sapience. Therefore, is what Kant calls the categories of the understanding. The threat relative to the categorical requirements on thought and experience would be the threat that they stand revealed as subjective impositions. If they stand revealed as merely subjective impositions, then Kant's position is a form of merely subjective idealism. So I will call a position, this is, I think, Hegelian vocabulary, this is how I understand it. McDowell sometimes uses this vocabulary. If you have a position in which you take one in the end to entail two, you are committed to subjective idealism. To call something subjective idealism when misunderstanding what it is to criticize the position. It's not a compliment. And then Hegel's question is, does transcendental idealism, does Kant's transcendental idealism stand revealed at the end of the day as a form of subjective idealism? Now, Hegel is going to charge yes. And not to confuse you, McDowell is going to agree with Hegel about that charge. But as McDowell understands the charge, and as McDowell understands Hegel's understanding of the charge, that's an internal criticism of Kant. That is, the aim was to provide a position that did not involve such an entailment. It's not an external criticism. Look at Kant's view. Of course it's that. It's to say that Kant did not fully succeed in carrying out the project that was the aim of the critique. Not the criticism that, given the way it's set up, of course, that's what it is. So it's a criticism about the details of the execution of the critique, not the bare frame. That's why I said, does transcendental idealism stand revealed at the end of the day, as rather than, is transcendental idealism a fortiori by definition a form of subjective idealism? So this on such a reading of Kant's project and the kind of failure Kant's being accused of, one can make sense both of Hegel's and McDowell's desires to represent themselves, in some sense, as true inheritors of Kant. Whereas it looks like in something like a standard reading, it's very hard not to see them as getting off the boat before it leaves the harbor. A different way of putting what Kant aims to show, putting it positively, I'll put it negatively so far by saying, Kant aims to provide us a view of this such that it does not entail this. That's a negative specification of Kant's aims. a positive way of putting Kant's aim here by McDowell's lights would be as follows. Kant takes himself to show that the requirements of the understanding are not just or merely subjective requirements, but genuine requirements on objects themselves. So things that initially come into view as forms of subjectivity have only been vindicated. We've only provided a deduction, that is, a vindication of our entitlement to them, if we can show they are genuine requirements on objects themselves. And not say, as Kant says would give the skeptic what he most desires, merely requirements on how we cannot help but, or how we cannot have, but apprehend the objects themselves. Okay. Now, in order to arrive at such a reading of Kant, there's a great deal in the standard reading of Kant one has to avoid. And there are here, I think, two basic ways of reading Kant, which by a McDowellian lights are going to count as ways of deforming Kant. And I think each of these ways of deforming Kant that I'm about to mention both come to the same thing and are two further ways of saying what I've been trying to say from the beginning. So a third and a fourth way of putting the aspiration. The first of these two ways of deforming Kant will involve doing what I will call Cartesianizing. To Cartesianize Kant, in the first instance, is to miss the level of his philosophical intervention and reflection upon the possibility of thought, knowledge, cognition, experience. So on your handout, finally the handout, something you can play with. On your handout, you have two quotations. The first, famous quotation from Descartes' Meditation. The second, a quotation from the A Deduction. In the first quotation, you have Descartes giving his dreaming argument. Descartes taking it for granted that he can have experience of a certain sort. And now what Descartes wants to know is, are things really as my experience represents them? So Descartes' question is one of the possible experiences I can have, how do I know which are true? And this generalizes into other forms of Cartesian problematic. Of the thoughts I can entertain about the world, how do I know which were the ones that reflect the truth about the world? So the possibility of enjoying determinate experiences that have the shape of being the sorts of things that could be true or false, that's taken for granted. And then the question is, how do I sift among these and winnow out the true ones? The second problem, and Descartes motivates this by giving an argument from dreaming. So he tries to show you, well, if things could be exactly as they seem, and yet I am dreaming, and there's no way to rule out the possibility of dreaming, there are no marks or features that distinguish dreaming from waking states, then the threat looms that I might merely be dreaming. And so now we're launched on a long and difficult task where we're going to try to get God involved in this, so we can have an argument that the way things seem and the way they really are conform to one another, despite the fact that from within our position, there's no way to distinguish the vividly dreaming state from the veridically perceptive state. The second passage is one in which Kant is questioning the possibility of that which Descartes takes for granted. Descartes asking, how do we infer from a certain kind of experience, which might be one of dreaming, for all we know, to things being thus and so? Kant's question, second passage, is how can our experience so much as have the sort of unity that it does, that it could appear to us as a case of one in which we are, say, in a dressing gown in front of a fireplace? That is, if experience lacked that sort of unity, as he says at the end of this passage, it would be less than a dream. So, to try to very quickly bring out the contrast, this is something that some of the people in this room know I can talk about at great length, but to try to bring out the contrast that's at issue here very quickly, I'll put it as a contrast between truth and what I'll call objective purport. Descartes' question is always, which of our thoughts, which of our experiences are the true ones? How do we advance from a truth to what we might call falling for it. It's truth value. How do we know when we judge truly? Kant's question about thoughts and about experiences is, how can they so much as have objective purport? How must they be constituted so they can even be the sorts of things about which a question could arise? Are they true or false? That you won't understand Kant, McDowell thinks, and you understand, unless you understand his initial level of intervention is to address that sort of question. And so the sort of skepticism that Kant in the first instance is trying to avert, a sort of skepticism made urgent by him by his understanding of what Hume's problem would be in its radical generalized form, would be one in which our experience adds up to less than a dream. It's a different sort of worry than the one Descartes trying to avert. Now, it is true that ultimately, as he makes explicit in the Beatitian, in the Refutation of Idealism, Kant does want to have a response to Descartes, to what Kant calls problematic idealism, which for him is merely a species and limiting case of this general problem of skepticism. I've just tried to explain. But we won't understand the character of that response unless we first understand that Kant is embarked in a level of investigation of this sort, where the task in particular of the transcendental deduction, and it's how one has to read the transcendental deduction in order to make sense of McDowell, that is my topic today. In the transcendental deduction, Kant's question is, how is it that we are so much as able to enjoy thoughts and modes of experience that have objective purport? That's the question. How is it that the categories have objective validity? How are they the sorts of things about which questions of truth and falsity, questions of their goodness, could so much as arise? So, first misreading of Kant is to fail to understand he's involved in an inquiry at this level, to too quickly shoehorn his meditations into a direct answer to a Cartesian skeptic. To take Kant, to immediately be trying to answer someone whose problem is the sort of problem that Descartes is concerned with, not seeing the character of the reflection he's initially engaged in, and therefore the kind of answer he's ultimately going to give to Descartes. I suggest the answer he's ultimately going to give to Descartes is one in which we are not able to distinguish in the way Descartes wants what we want to infer from to what we want to infer to. We wouldn't be able to have Descartes' conception of what is revealed to us in Res Cogitans unless there already was, as Kant puts it, a possibility of ordering things in outer sense as well as inner sense. So the criticism of Descartes ultimately is not when we accept the terms of his setup and then say, here's how you sort, given that you set things up that way. The criticism of Descartes is ultimately going to be one in which the very Cartesian conception of a form of subjectivity is a self-standing realm whose layout is the way it would be, regardless of how things are with the objects, is itself challenged. Descartes' conception is one in which one entails two in a very direct and massive way. If you have Descartes' conception of what a form of subjectivity is, how things are with the objects is something that doesn't come into view through a form of subjectivity at all. Whether I'm dreaming of such and such is the case, or whether I'm perceiving it, are as possible subjective conditions of my kind of apparatus, indistinguishable. There's some further fact about the accord between these things that has to be handled for it to turn out that the present layout of my form of subjectivity, and now you have to say something like, happens to be also how things are. So the kind of argument you get in Descartes essentially is one in which, don't worry, God has designed us in such a way that when our form of subjectivity has this shape, if it's clear and distinct enough, it is moreover also the case that things are really that way. That was the first way of deforming Kant. Second way of deforming Kant, and I'm claiming, though I won't flesh this out now because it'll take too much time, but a topic for discussion if someone wants to ask me why. I'm claiming this really is the same thing put in different words. And I think this will make it more vivid how it is that most standard readings of Kant are quite different from McDowell's. The other way of deforming Kant is to offer what I will call a two-stage reading of Kant. So on your handout, under two, you have something I list as the generically Kantian thought. I take it that anybody who's a reader of the Critique of Pure Reason is going to have to assent to this first thing here in some form or other. There are these two sources of knowledge, senses and morals, apparently, sensibility and understanding. They're each necessary, neither is sufficient. And then the question is, how do we fill in that generically Kantian thought? It comes up in many places. One place it comes up is what I'm calling the Kantian dictum. In Kant's saying, intuitions without concepts are blind. Concepts without intuitions are empty. The first quotation in Roman 3 in your handout gives you the context for that. A51 B715. How are we to understand that? Well, on the two-stage reading, a way of understanding that would be, you can have each without the other. But you don't have knowledge or experience in demanding sense unless you have both somehow combined or cooperating. You got intuitions, but alas, they'd be blind. You got concepts, but alas, those concepts would be empty. In raising a question about how we understand the Kantian dictum, we're also raising a question of how Kant means to be aligning himself with the tradition upon which he wants to perform critique. So, empiricism and rationalism are each summed up as positions in which one could think that each half of this dictum is accorded a certain privilege. The empiricist is inclined to think it's our mode of receptivity in the first sense gives us knowledge. We have impressions of red, triangle, and so forth. And then, you know, to fully have knowledge, we have to have ideas, and these have to be arranged. But the initial state of cognitive awareness is one that's yielded by receptivity. A rationalist is inclined to think something like the opposite. To think, no, in the first instance, what it is to have knowledge is to have a clear and distinct idea of a certain thing. To have a certain kind of concept, and then maybe a story about how this concept has been implanted, such that it's the right one. And then, of course, it's nice to hook these things up to what we sense, because that allows us to do things we wouldn't otherwise do, but we still have a kind of awareness, a kind of thought genuinely directed at the world, in virtue of having such divinely implanted concepts, called innate ideas, if you like. And it can look like then, so construed, empiricism and rationalism contradict one another. And the only game is to choose between the argument they have with one another. And I think it's true of most readings of Kant that that's not what he wants to do. That he wants to rehabilitate some truth in empiricism, which I've tried to state. The numbering here is a bit funky, isn't it? Let's call that 3-prime. Some truth in idealism, let's call that 4-prime. And show that these can be reconciled. To reconcile them involves avoiding what you might call the twin perils of each. Kant calls them skepticism and dogmatism. I've called them on your handout here vicious empiricism, vicious idealism, respectively. And that means there's a possibility of vindicating the truth of each in such a way that they can be reconciled while averting both skepticism and dogmatism. And the question is, how do you do that? And the standard reading of this involves seeing Kant do this through the application of what I'm calling a two-stage. So, what are blind intuitions? What are empty concepts? On a two-stage reading, they're kinds of exercises of our cognitive capacities that we can enjoy in full independence of each other, but it's somehow only if they are simultaneously or mutually or successively exercised that it, and now I think you have to say something like, adds up to knowledge. And the question is, can we make sense of such a figure, of accretion, of elements, thus understood as independent moments, as something that yields a picture of empirical knowledge? So McDowell's way of reading Kant is going to be to resist a two-stage reading. There's lots of possible kinds of two-stage readings. I'm trying to put this at a level of generality that brings out how fundamental the break here is. One kind of two-stage reading is to say, well, these two stages are temporally independent, First, sensibility impinges on us in a certain way. We enjoy elements of the sensory array, common intuitions, if you like. Then we bring these fully unconceptualized items under concepts. Only after such a synthesis understood here as it were the transition from stage one to stage two, do we have, and so forth. Temporal independence, successive temporal stages. Another way to understand it, that way of understanding it leaves open that these might be moments in apperception. First I enjoy, as it were, a bare, raw experience of a certain sense quality, then I bring it under concept. Another reading is to say, no, these are independent, temporally dependent stages, but it's only once we've completed the process that we have something that can figure as an element of apperception. If you're reading Conhard, there'll be some pressure to say that. So you'll think, this is something like stages of cognitive processing. But it's only once we're at the output end of the cognitive process that we enjoy something that can apperceptively come into view as an element of the unity of apperception. Nonetheless, there are these two stages. Then it starts looking like the transcendental aesthetic is actually about something that happens off stage with respect to consciousness. It gets hard to read those arguments. But there's a pressure, if you want to hang on to the two-stage reading, to go that way. Another way to have a two-stage reading is to construe these as logically. They're not temporally independent moments. All I'll say for the moment is that McDowell is committed to a reading of Kant in which the whole point of Kant is to show you that any understanding of the generically Kantian thought on the two-stage model yields you a merely restrictive conception of subjectivity. That is the point. It's to come to see that we need to understand the capacities that come into view first as our capacity to enjoy sensible representations, our Vermögen of Sinnlichkeit, and our capacity to traffic in concepts, our Vermögen of Verstand, as themselves constituent exercises of a unified capacity to acquire knowledge. A Vermögen for Erkenntnis. And that any attempt to analyze that unified capacity into atomic elements that are accreted is precisely what yields the problem of a subjectivist conception of knowledge. And that that's equally a problem for empiricism and rationalism. It doesn't matter whether you say, with Hume, as Kant puts it in section 27, it's the mere repetition of custom and experience, or whether you say with Descartes, it's a divine deity who's implanted. The character of the connection that's forged between the elements that are yielded at each of these stages. Either way, we're representing the character of the necessity as a way we cannot help but think. Bit more about the second way of deforming Kant. This takes us to the second quotation under Roman 3. The second and the third, actually. So we might ask, what are blind intuitions? What are empty concepts? And the answer that McDowell's going to be committed to, and you can see mind and world is already the beginning of his attempting to think through such a commitment, is going to be one in which a blind intuition is not revealed as a species of the genus intuition. Rather, a blind intuition is no more a kind of intuition than, as Frege puts it, stage thunder, as a kind of thunder. That is, once we see that a capacity to draw on our capacities for conceptualization is a condition of something having the unity of intuition, then what we see is that what we want to see as immediate, singular, sensory states in the absence of any drawing on that capacity turn out to be merely blind. That is not a kind of intuition. And similarly about concepts, if what concepts are supposed to be are modes of representation that have genuine empirical content that allow us to direct our thought at the world in such a way that our thought is capable of what Kant calls objective validity. That is, it can yield judgments that are true and false, that are candidates for truth and falsehood. Then again, this is not something it can do without a connection to our capacity to enjoy sensory awareness of objects. Thus, concepts as empty are concepts that fail in virtue of the respect in which something must not fail if it is to be a concept which has genuine application. That leaves a question about what Kant's doing in the dialectic, which I'd be pleased to have somebody write. You can see quotations 2 and quotations 3 as instances of how strongly Kant wants to put this issue. So in the B deduction, section 23, he will say, in a noticeable anticipation of Frege's vocabulary, that concepts without any relation to sensibility are ohne Sinn und Bedeutung, without sense and meaning. In section 3, in the preamble to the deduction, an important passage is kept in both the A and the B deduction, despite the massive rewriting that happens between them. Kant entertains a possibility. I will call it the possibility of rogue intuitions. That's the possibility at issue in this passage. This is Roman 3, quotation 2 on your handout. It's important to me here that the Norman Kemp Smith translation of the critique, and actually several others, are not so great. That is, something is raised here in the subjunctive mood in Kant that tends to get translated into English in the indicative mood, which misses the fact that a certain possibility is being floated. And now the question of the deduction is, what are we to make of this possibility? The possibility, as Kant puts it, is, skipping a few sentences into the quotation, appearances might very well be so constituted that the understanding should not find them to be in accordance with the conditions of its unity. So, however, whatever you think the two stages are, this is a way of raising a question about the two-stage reading with respect to the priority and independence of sensibility. Could what comes in and be delivered as part of the manifold of sensibility be such that the understanding can do nothing with it? Such that nothing presents itself which yields a rule of synthesis, as he goes on to say. And if we have a certain, and Kant certainly wants to argue that there is a sense in which our capacities for enjoying representations and concepts, our ability to exercise our faculties of sensible understanding are independent. This is how we understand the independence. If we understand it that way, then it would seem that appearances could present objects to our intuition, while those objects are, as Kant puts it, nothing to us. And the standard reading of the critique, this is, now there's so many readings of the critique, it's a bit hard to speak the standard of time. But many readings of the critique, Henry Allison is, I think, a famous case of this, take this question to be one that represents the shape of the situation. And now what we want is an argument that says, though things might very well be this way, as it happens, we might say, phew, it turns out they're not. We're going to give an argument that shows that, it's amazingly Cartesian argument that you wind up with in Kant. That is, it's not because of God it turns out there's this fit between what happens on the inside and what happens on the outside, but because of some fact about the categories, there's supposed to be a conclusion effect that, but don't worry, the forms of understanding fit the forms of sensibility. So we don't get any of these cases. So the categories are supposed to be vindicated. And roughly speaking, McDowell's thought is, if that's the shape of the argument, then Kant is no better off than Descartes. And indeed, we still have a view of this form. Our forms of subjectivity are merely subjective. It just turns out that we're supposed to acquiesce in this brief fact that things fit this way in a way that's supposed to provide us with a certain relief. And by McDowell's lights, it's because there's a tendency to backslide into construing the quest of the transcendental deduction to be a Cartesian one. That one can so much as think this is the right strategy for reading the transcendental deduction. So the tendency is then, and Pippin is very explicit about this, to ask, to take the question to be something that can be paraphrased like this. How do we know our categories are the right ones? Maybe our categories aren't the right ones. Maybe they're merely our categories. And so what a vindication, a deduction of the categories we come to is showing, it's okay we have these and not others. But that is precisely to take Kant at this point in the critique to still be operating with a Cartesian question. The question is not how do we know the categories give us the right one to think true thoughts. The question is, how can we so much as have experience or thoughts that are such a space that they can be true or false? Once one sees that that's the level of the investigation, then this kind of story about how one's trying to answer the worry about rogue appearances doesn't even seem to meet the problem. So one of the things I think you often get in Kant commentators is an official lip service to what Kant says in deduction, that his concern is with the possibility of experience, how we can so much as have unity of consciousness, how it is that our experience can add up to more than a dream, or less than, not more than less than a dream. But what you wind up sliding into is an answer to a question that doesn't have that shape, but an answer to something that is really a transposition of a Cartesian problem. Yeah. Okay, now let's get a little more textual. The next thing you have on your handout are a statement of three exegetical puzzles. And incredibly quickly, I'm going to tell you how I think McDowell wants to resolve each of these. And further, I want to suggest that the resolution of each presupposes the proper resolution of the other two. The three exegetical puzzles are, first, a puzzle about the relationship between the first half and the second half of the doctrine of elements, the relationship between the transcendental aesthetic and the transcendental analytic. In the transcendental aesthetic, certain formal conditions on cognition come into view, conditions of sensibility. A form of subjectivity that is the form of our sentience comes into view. Then, early on, the transcendental analytic, another set of formal conditions on cognition come into view. Are forms of sapience, the forms of the understanding. And this is a question about how are these related? And if one has a two-stage reading of the generically Kantian thought, and thus a two-stage construal of what the Kantian dictum comes to, then you've got a question in which you want to know how does the one fit the other, or how few does it turn out that we have the right kind of accord. That's not the reading McDowell's going to offer of how to understand the relationship between these two halves of the first half of the book. Second puzzle, what's the relation of the two versions of the transcendental deduction? Kant gave a version of the transcendental deduction in the A edition, and then he rewrote it in the B edition. And there's various controversy about why he did that. He rewrote some other things too. I think the other things he rewrote are immediately connected with the rewriting of the A edition. But you might ask, why did he do that? There's a question about whether these are, you know, two versions of the same argument, which he's trying to show the same thing, or whether it really is a junking of the strategy of the original book and some other attempt to go at the problem. What I'm going to suggest in a moment is that McDowell's reading of Kant requires us to make sense of how to answer this question in a particular way, and in some ways a satisfying way, which is the possibility comes into view that Kant rewrote the B deduction, rewrote the deduction in the B edition to avert precisely this misunderstanding of the A deduction. That it's rewritten precisely to make it explicit that all of the reviews that think he has a version of this problem. It usually comes into view in the literature as a problem of bar cleaner ideas, but that's just one, as it were, I think, somewhat local way of specifying what the fundamental problem is. That reading is a misreading of what he's trying to accomplish. Third exegetical puzzle. If you read the B deduction, one of the striking things about it is it comes in two halves. It goes on for a while, he stops. It says something pretty close to the following. This is not a quotation. You might think I'm done. I'll even add some words. If you read the deduction the way most people read the A deduction, I should be done. But only a beginning has been made. I'm not done. Seeing that I'm not done should help you see that what I'm trying to do is very different than what there's a tremendous pressure to assume I must be trying to do. So how are the first and the second half of the B deduction related? And now what I'm going to do is I'm going to answer these three questions in reverse order. The third, the second, and then the first, real fast. So what's Kant trying to show in the second half of the B deduction? What he's trying to show in the second half of the B deduction is, as he puts it, as we'll see in a moment, we have several ways of putting it. I think actually it's important to see these different ways come to the same thing. But here's one of them. The unity of our mode of intuition is none other than that which the categories prescribe. Or, to connect that with a thought that comes up earlier in the clue, which you have is quotation one, and which you might sum up under the slogan, there's only one unity. The same function which gives unity to the various representations in a judgment also gives unity to the mere synthesis of various representations in an intuition. That is, on a two-stage reading, we initially have what looked to be independent forms of subjectivity that have a completely different character. And then that means that we inevitably fall into thinking of these as, in some sense, stages of processing. And in so understanding them, we inevitably fall into a restrictive conception of subjectivity. So the goal is to show that these forms of subjectivity that come into view in empiricism and rationalism, respectively, is utterly distinct requirements on knowledge. And it looks like in the classical debate, we need to figure out which is the tail and which is the dog, which wags the other, do not represent independent forms of unity, but independent exercises, independent aspects of a single unified capacity for representation. No aspect of which can fully intelligibly come into view, independently of an appreciation of its dependence on the others. So as McDowell summarizes his view in the article of McDowell's that some of you might have read, which is the shortest, the first half of that is the shortest statement I know of the kind of reading of Kant he's offered that I'm attempting to explicate in more detail. He says, if you want a slogan, here's a slogan, there's only one unity, common to the aesthetic and the analytic. Not two separate and independent unities. So that already gives you a hint of what his answer to the first exegetical puzzle is going to be. Why rewrite the deduction the way he does in the B addition? The B addition is structured so as to void an objection that, on a misreading of the A deduction, might look urgent. If what Kant wants to establish is that the objective purport of experience can be explained in terms of the role of the pure concepts of the understanding, the objection is going to be that that condition is only a condition for thinkability. That's only a condition for requirements of the understanding. But the way things might really be might be richer than that, so that all we're able to think is that which fits those requirements, as I put it before. That's the worry that comes with the worry about rogue appearances. And before I go on, let me just emphasize what the worry is here and what it's not. The worry the deduction is trying to address is not the following, which is generally assumed to be. How do we know that our forms of understanding are the right ones? In fact, if you read the critique, you won't find Kant talking about our forms of understanding. As we'll see in a moment, he does talk about our forms of sensibility. But to take the forms of understanding to be merely ours is to misunderstand what Kant is doing from the ground up by McDowell's lights. It is to block the possibility that he's even inspiring to avert the possibility of this entanglement. If the forms of understanding are merely ours, then they are, in some sense, merely subjective. They are restrictively subjective. And I mention that because most discussions of analytic philosophy that want to relate Frege or Tractatus or whatever to Kant take transcendental idealism to be a worry about and a strategy for making ourselves comfortable with the fact that our forms of understanding are merely ours, but it's okay. So the very worry that's animating the transcendental reduction this reading is not that, which doesn't make it less urgent. The objection is rather, given that these are conditions on thinkability as such, why isn't conformity to their requirements still such as not to give us requirements on objective knowledge, on the objects? And if you think a condition for objects to be sensible is not enough for them to be a condition to be given to the senses, if you think what you're getting in the aesthetic and the analytic are fully, in that sense, separate and independent conditions on cognition, first set of conditions, objects must be spatiotemporally organized. Second set of conditions, they must be thinkable. Then, for all Kant can show, objects could be presented to our senses even though they are unthinkable. This is what you have McDowell saying in Romans 6 on your handout. That's the objection that the V-deduction is structured to avoid. And as McDowell sums it up at the end of that quotation, on these lines, if you read him that way, things look bad for the claim that Kant is aiming at, that the pure concepts of the understanding have genuinely objective validity. Or as I put it before, that they are conditions for forms of thought and experience that have objective purport. Or that they are forms of subjectivity that turn out not to be merely restrictive or merely subjective conditions on an apprehension of how objects are. So that's a claim about how the A and the B deduction are related. Let's look at the text and see if they bear this out. So section 20 of the deduction is the climactic section of the first half of the deduction. And the reason commentators have a lot of trouble with this, if they have a standard reading, is it really is true. On a standard reading, it looks like Kant should already be done at the end of the first half of the B deduction. In fact, it looks like he's gone even too far, maybe. Now he's done, but he's overshot the mark. And so that leaves a kind of question, what's the second half of the deduction for? And you have some people who read it as a second argument for the same conclusion. Some people who read it as something like, Kant has shown this is true of forms of sensibility, and now he's going to show it's true of our forms of sensibility, which is the transition from a universal generalization to an existential instance of it, which everyone knows who's taken introductory logic is a one-step argument. It should take so many pages for him to do it, if that's all he's doing. So there is a problem here for standard readers, which McDowell, I think, might be have something attractive to say about how we can make sense of. The strong conclusion that you seem to have at the end of the first half of the deduction in B, in quotation one, is put like this. All sensible intuitions are subject to the categories as conditions under which alone their manifold can come together in one consciousness. All sensible intuitions are subject to the categories. And then he goes on and says, all the manifold, so far just given in a single empirical intuition, whenever any part of the manifold is given a single empirical intuition, it must already be determined in respect of one of the logical functions of judgment and thereby brought into one consciousness. It looks very much like what Kant is saying here, is for something to so much as have the unity of an intuition, it must be in accord with the unities of categories prescribed. And if that's right, then it would look like But we can't have intuitions without categories, in which case this question, what were we talking about in the transcendental aesthetic? And if you look at the German, that reading is in fact even somewhat more suggested by a somewhat agrammatical feature of Kant's rendition of this first clause of quotation two in the German. He capitalizes the indefinite article to, as it were, emphasize that it's both an indefinite article and conceptually related to the bare idea of the unity of an intuition. Also, ist alles mannigfaltiger, sofern es in einer. You don't usually capitalize the indefinite article in German. You capitalize a lot of things you don't know, but not that. But Kant does here. In einer empirischen Anschauung gegeben, insofar as something is given as an intuition, that it has the conditions that are the conditions, the possibility of something coming into view as so much as being an intuition, as being that kind of representation. It's according to the logical function of judgments required. Now, the fact that, especially in the B deduction, especially in the first half, Kant seems to be making very strong claims about how the categories are required in order to have something that can be the kind of representation intuition is, namely a singular immediate representation. That's not news. And there's various strategies for dealing with this. So it's worth just mentioning them for a moment to bring out what the stakes are between McDowell's reading and other readings of Kant. One sort of strategy is to say, well, there are really two kinds of intuition. We have to introduce some terminological clarity. And there's various proposals for how to do this. So, on section Roman 8 of your handout, under number 1, you have Allison building on a suggestion of W.H. Walsh. The suggestion is, initially, what we mean by intuition in the critique are unconceptualized modes of relating to an object. They are only proleptically intuitions in a singular and second and stronger sense. What Kant's talking about in the deduction is intuitions that can represent something that we can actually see as having the content of being of a triangle, of red, and so forth. In order for them to have that kind of content, concepts are required. So there's two notions of intuition. And Kant just wasn't careful about this. That's one way of doing it. There's many other ways of doing this. But the generic character of this strategy is, let's distinguish two senses of intuition where Kant failed to. And that will explain why he's saying things in the first half of the B deduction, and generally the deduction, that seem to challenge a two-stage model for reading the critique. In quotation 2 and 3, you have Lewis White Beck giving what I think is the most sophisticated version of such a proposal, which I won't go through here, but he tries to distinguish between what he calls an inspectional and a functional conception of intuition. So intuition is the first sense for things that I could merely enjoy in virtue of exercising my sensibility, but they really couldn't be ingredients in judgments unless they were further articulated in a way that would allow them to play a certain kind of function in the context of a judgment, say, be possible subjects or predicates. And that requires concepts and the larger structure of judgmental articulation that comes to the understanding. So again, two senses of intuition. Now, the main thing to say here is that by Kant, by McDowell's lights, to thus read Kant is to miss everything. That precisely the conceptions that are being presupposed here of being able to enjoy something that has genuinely representational content on the cheap in that way, is precisely to fall into a version of the myth of the good, is precisely to attribute to Kant the very error that he needs to overcome to avoid vicious empiricism, as I defined it earlier in the handout. Secondly, it's maybe just worth mentioning that this strategy, also just as an exegetical strategy, sounds maybe modest, but it's quite a mess. If you tried to carry this through as an exegetical strategy, you'd realize very quickly, we don't just need a distinction between two senses of intuition. We need a distinction between two senses of manifold. And we need a distinction between two senses of faculty of sensibility. And we need a distinction between two senses of synthesis. Actually, we're going to have to start doubling most of the business terms in the critique And then if we want to know which con is talking about when, we are going to have to make it up. And the pressures that we're initially trying to solve here through this distinction are actually going to multiply through the text, as we'll realize there are reasons to go both ways at many different points. We're probably going to wind up needing to distinguish two senses of representation and so forth. So if one takes what Kant's doing in the aesthetic to be introducing something like a definition of what intuitions are, which we can have for free, and then rolling on board further supplemental conditions and understanding, one will precisely miss the kind of critique of Cartesianism he has by McDowell's lights. Just as if, as the Cartesian conception of an inner realm is the presumption of a kind of self-standing set of conditions on the apprehension of objects, so the conception of sensibility as a genuine mode of cognition, of a self-standing sphere, is part of what McDowell's taking Kant to be criticizing. So in McDowell's reading, what we get early on in the critique are glosses on what these notions must mean if they are to do the philosophical work they're supposed to. What must intuitions be? Well, they must be singular, immediate forms of representation as opposed to general, mediate ones like concepts. But then the question is, to vindicate our entitlement to such a gloss, how much does it cost to be able to have intuitions thus understood come into view? And it's part of McDowell's reading that it's only once Kant has completed the Transcendental Analytic as a whole that he's fully vindicated his entitlement to those notions. As Kant says in the Doctrine of Method, philosophy must not begin with definitions. Mathematics can do that, but not philosophy. Philosophy proceeds by way of clarification of concepts. And definitions, if possible at all, is only possible at the end of the task of philosophy. Few more things and we'll come to an end. Now, section 21 of the Beta Doctrine. What we have in section 21 is Kant explicitly saying, quotation 1, only a beginning has been made on a proper deduction of the categories if we stop with what we had in section 20. The above proposition is section 20, the one we've been worrying about so far. And then he goes on in quotation 2 on your handout, under Roman 9, to say, in what follows, it will be shown from the mode in which the empirical intuition is given in sensibility that its unity is no other than that which the category prescribes to the manifold of a given intuition in general. So a way of putting what Kant's doing here, a different way of putting the objection that the B deduction is structured to avert, might be put like this. You can imagine an interlocutor reading the conclusion of section 20 and saying, okay, I see. If we want intuitions to be intuitions in this demanding sense that allows them to be possible subjects of predicates, to be possible elements of judgment, to be really able to figure as ingredients of a unity of that perception, then we require the concepts, we require the understanding. But, of course, there is this weaker notion of intuition that came into view in the aesthetic. And as raised by the possibility of rogue appearances, those we might enjoy, even though such, quote, intuitions do not yield any real synthesis. And you can even imagine this interlocutor going further and saying, and you know what, Kant? I'll give you the word intuition. So let's say the second sense of intuition is what we mean by intuition. Those require the logical functions of judgment. But it's still possible for something to be an object of the senses. If for us to have genuinely sensory cognitive relation to an object while it's falling short on the conditions of intuition that have come to be at the end of the first half of the B deduction. And then you can see the B deduction as it announces the goal in the second half to be precisely to rebut that claim of the interlocutor. So what Kant says is, we want to show the mode in which the empirical intuition is given is none other than the unity the categories have. And then he reformulates this as showing the categories are valid in respect of all objects of our senses. So you get a number of switches in terminology. First he talks about our relation to objects as being a relation to objecto. And then the question is, once we lift the abstraction in place in the first half of the B deduction and ask how things are with our forms of sensibility, you could ask, okay, what's how it is if we want to have knowledge of objecta, that is, thoughts that can be structured in accordance with the principles of the understanding. But if what is to be related to a Gegenstand is just to be related to sensibility, are these conditions on our apprehension of Gegenstand? And he wants to say yes. Conversely, you can see the point of his introducing the category of Gegenstände der Sinne as saying, okay, if you want to restrict the conception of an Anschauung to that which meets the conditions that come into view in the first half of the B deduction, then it still remains to be shown that the categories can't be understood as thus restricted. These forms of sensibility and those forms of sensibility cannot be taken to be thus independent. These must be conditions on anything being apprehensible as something that can come into view for the Sinne. So the very strategy of how it's rewritten starts to make sense in the light of this being the objection he's trying to avert. I'll just say, there's more in the handout which I won't go into, I'll just say something about where McDowell takes the problem in Kant to be. So McDowell is trying to give a reading of Kant where Kant really is trying to vindicate his entitlement to a non-subjectivistic conception of forms of subjectivity. But Kant does think that he must concede this much to the empiricists. Let's go back to the problem that we addressed at the beginning, which is, of course, the forms of sensibility are in some sense ours. That is, that we perceive things as we do has something to do with our sensory constitution. And there must be a brute element to the character of our sensory constitution. Thus far, I don't think anyone will disagree. McDowell's certainly not concerned to disagree. But then, the forms of sensibility that are the complement to the forms of understanding that are playing the role they do in the transcendental deduction are taken to be space and time. Where space and time, on the one hand, are introduced as if they were conditions on our being able to sort things in outer sense at all, in order to be able to so much as recognize something as the same again, to be able to pick it up, in order to be the kind of thing that can be a stable, enduring element of a sensory array. It must be in accordance with those forms. But the forms of sensibility are also introduced as having a particular character. There's a particular geometry, Euclidean geometry. They indicate that. And there's even a suggestion that the form of intersense is in some sense parallelly ours. And that, McDowell thinks, that conception of the forms of sensibility, if left on its own, without further development, is going to introduce a kind of rot that's going to spread and undermine the ambition of the deduction. That unless we can understand the forms of sensibility as not just conformable to the categories in the very strong sense he's trying to show, and understand the categories as being conditions of thought as such, but unless we can understand some aspect of sensibility as an aspect of our sensible constitution to be not merely ours, we're still going to have the problem of lapsing into a restrictivist conception of subjectivity. This is how McDowell wants to understand what Hegel means, when Hegel says, but transcendental idealism does in the end stand revealed as a subjective idealism. Stop there. Thank you.